BBC World Service for Africa. Hello, this is Akwesi Sapo in London with This Week in Africa. And for the next half hour, we look back at the people and events that have made news in Africa this week. Four men in South African police custody are bound for court over the shooting of Rwanda's exiled ex-army chief. Torrential rains claim lives and wreak havoc on homes as floods hit some West African countries.
The water entered here. Yeah. But you poke blocks to walk on to go inside because of the water.
For the water. In the room, sir. How do you live? Where will you go? We cannot live.
Prisoners in Kenya win the right to vote.
It is a fantastic jurisprudence, and the progressive way in which the judges have been able to bring it out is something that is really, really welcome.
And our new visa application rules to the UK unfairly denying African artists a spot at international concerts. Let's start from Rwanda, where it's been news of arrests and shootings, all linked with people thought to be victimized because of their opposition to the government. First, the exiled former army chief of staff based in South Africa was shot in the stomach after a shopping trip with his wife in Johannesburg. Back in Kigali, at least 20 opposition protesters were arrested on the same day as incumbent President Kagame filed his nomination papers for presidential elections up in August. And then on Thursday, a newspaper reporter was shot dead in front of his house in the capital. With all this happening ahead of elections and fingers being pointed at the government, what is going on? The BBC's Jeffrey Mutagoma in Kigali reports.
The death of this young journalist has shocked many journalists in Rwanda who remain baffled about the circumstances of his apparent assassination. Rwanda's police spokesperson, Superintendent Eric Karanga, told me that Jean-Leonard Rugambage was shot at 10 o'clock last night as he pulled up outside his gate and was waiting to enter his property. Police say they found him dead in his car after they were informed by neighbours who heard the shooting. People who arrived on the scene minutes after the shooting say he bled to death from two gunshots in the neck. The police spokesperson told me that there were no suspects so far and that it was carrying out investigations into the case. Leonard Rugambage was the acting editor of Umuvugizi newspaper, a Kinyarwanda tabloid which was suspended along with Omuseso newspaper in April this year. The High Media Council, which imposed the suspension, accused the papers of violation of the media law and inciting public disorder. A few days later, Umuvugizi editorial team decided to publish their paper on the website. Sources close to the paper say it was investigating the shooting of Rwandan General Kayumba Nyamwasa in South Africa, an incident in which the Rwandan state has denied any involvement. In 2006, Rugambage was acquitted of genocide crimes by a local Gacaca court in central Rwanda. Jean-Leonard Rugambage is survived by his wife and a child.
Jeffrey Mutagoma in Kigali. It's a perennial problem, flooding caused by torrential rains and wreaking havoc across West Africa. Ghana, Liberia and Togo were assessing the destruction and the death toll as homes and roads were swept off by floods. On Monday, disaster management officials in Ghana said the floods claimed at least 20 lives after hours of heavy rainfall that affected the southern parts of the country, including the Greater Accra region, where the capital is. The BBC's David Amano reports from there.
In one of the worst-hit areas known as Ashaiman, two people got trapped and drowned in a single carriageway tunnel under the Tema Accra motorway. Around 3,000 people were displaced by the flash floods, some clinging to the roofs of their homes, until the Ghanaian Navy came to their rescue in small boats. Two river crossings in the central region were destroyed, bringing traffic between Accra and Cape Coast to a standstill. Another river burst its banks near Tema, rendering a major route to the east impassable for several hours. It is not unusual at this time of year, as the long rainy season is expected and indeed welcomed by farmers. Local government authorities blame the annual incidence of flooding in urban areas on the unauthorized building of homes and other structures on open drains and waterways. There is a demolition exercise currently underway in Accra and Tema to deal with these structures. However, it is questionable whether the demolitions have made any impact on efforts to reduce the flooding.
David Amano in Accra. For Liberians, the rains in the capital were especially bad with news of the drowning of a two-year-old. Monrovia was built in the 19th century for less than 500,000 people, but now is home to over 1 million. Talk shows on local FM radio stations were flooded with calls from those affected. Many of them accused the government of abandoning them. The BBC's Jonathan Pelele went to find out more.
As the water enters in the house, it seems to be that the person is feeling happy about it. Because
she's not feeling happy. How are you managing today?
Just on the street. We are not managing nothing.
The OSAT broadcasting team of Truth FM, a Monrovia broadcaster, talking to an understandably emotional flawed victim who alleges that President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has done nothing to address their plight even after visiting their area some time ago.
I am in a Monrovia community where homes are still submerged. Residents are fighting to get water out of their homes. Your house is so close to the river. Tell me your situation here.
The water can enter here.
The water entered here? Yeah. Okay, you poke blocks to walk on to go inside because of the water?
For the water. In the room, sir.
Okay, I see the water is all around here.
Mm-hmm.
I also have this brother here. I realize that every time it rains a bit, this whole community is flooded. Are you people planning to leave this community someday?
How do you leave? Where will you go? We cannot leave.
What do you think can be done now?
Well, we need assistance. The government should assist us.
Internal Affairs Minister Harrison Kanwe, who heads the National Disaster Relief Effort, saying at least 12 communities are now affected in Monrovia and elsewhere.
Those people affected may be in the tens of thousands. We are in contact with some of our international partners, our local partners, putting meager resources together to move in to give some minimum relief.
Some flood victims say President Sirleaf has not done anything to help them.
When she visits those areas, she definitely instructs us to follow up on those visits. And let me assure the victims in this public manner that follow-up visitations will be done, and I will be in the forefront of it.
Liberia's Internal Affairs Minister Harrison Kanwe ending Jonathan Pelele's report. Well, the heavy rainfall is also affecting Togo, whose Prime Minister Gilbert Hungbo was in London. He spoke to my colleague Veronique Edwards.
When you lose one life, is too much.
Have you lost any people in this flood?
Yes, indeed,
how many?
Indeed, we lost three youngsters 2 weeks ago, which was very, very painful for us. Since I'm in London right now, I want all my people that are listening to me, that all my thoughts are in Lomé. We have to manage people that are to be out of their houses and trying to relocate them to other families.
Do you have the facilities, so you need help?
Both. We are not yet appealing for external help at this stage, but we do have a setup together with the partners, locally based partners, that when we get to a certain point, then we can start the rapid response, international rapid response. We are not at the international rapid response appeal at this stage.
Togo's Prime Minister Gilbert Hungbo speaking to the BBC's Veronique Edwards. Guinea's presidential elections are slated for Sunday, and campaigns peaked this week with rival party supporters crisscrossing the country in a search for votes. The election is expected to draw a line under military rule in months of turmoil that followed the death of President Lansana Conte in 2008. So what issues will voters consider before choosing their next president? Well, before voting day, our Conakry reporter, Ala Santilla, went to find out.
There's little doubt now that Guineans are ready for June the 27th, the day the country will hold what has widely been described as the first real democratic presidential election, as is demonstrated by these frenetic scenes by supporters. After over 50 years of independence, Guinea has known only two elected heads of state, Sekou Touré and Lansana Conte. But the democratic credentials of their elections have always been questioned, both at home and abroad. And while the country has vast mineral and natural resources, still it faces poverty, the absence of basic necessities, and a breakdown in governance. So, with this newfound democracy frenzy gripping voters, I sought to find out the issues they will be looking at before electing the next head of state.
The changes I would like to see brought to this country include new ways of doing things, of advising and governing ourselves. It is truly deplorable that after 50 years, we are still at the same level, while other nations that gain independence after us are now ahead of us.
For me, I can see that after 50 years, Guinea has lagged behind, and for me, the right to vote means to choose the person who will get us out of our misery.
The backwardness and hardship expressed by these voters have also led to insecurity across the country. Many crimes, including robberies, hold-ups, and beatings, are committed by armed men often dressed in military combat fatigues. And the seizure of power by the military following the death of former President Lansana Conte in late 2008 exacerbated the situation for ordinary people. This situation has clearly not endeared ordinary citizens to their compatriots in the armed forces. This young man speaks here for many Guineans.
It's true that the army has done very bad things to us, and that is why I want them to go back to their barracks and leave us to live our lives. They tortured us for a long time as though we are a people at war, and we are hoping that if they leave, we will live a good life.
The sense of awareness of global political changes has reached this one dark corner of the African continent, and many people in Guinea can't wait to democratically elect a new leader and join the rest of the civilized world.
Alassane Sela compiled that report from Guinea. Next to Kenya, where the novelty of prisoners being given a say in the country's governance was applauded. In jails, prisoners there have been given the right to vote in the referendum on a new constitution. In a historic ruling, five judges sitting in a special constitutional court ordered the government to allow prison inmates to register within 3 weeks. The case came about after prisoners in the coastal city of Mombasa claimed that their rights as citizens were being violated by not being allowed to decide how they should be governed. The BBC's Odhiambo Joseph was in court.
The court ordered the registration of inmates as voters in all 90 prison institutions in the country to be done immediately so as to allow prisoners to take part in the August 4th referendum on the proposed new Kenya constitution. But Kenya's electoral body told the court that reopening the voters' register to allow fresh registrations will be illegal and practically impossible. However, the Constitution Dispute Resolution Court dismissed this argument. Justice Samuel Mukunya delivered the judgment on behalf of the five judges.
We do not think that registration of 53,000 inmates or less in 90 institutions, which institutions nearly all are near urban centres, can pose such a challenge that can set the electoral process in a fatal spin as alleged by the second respondent. In this era of electronic advancement, they should not pose a challenge in our view. This can be done well in advance of August 4th referendum. We further order that the registration for inmates aforesaid be done in such a way that it does not disrupt the ongoing referendum process.
The court insisted that to enable prisoners to take part in the national referendum, they must be near polling stations. Here again is Justice Mukunya.
The Interim Independent Electoral Commission do gazette the prisons as polling stations, and that they facilitate the registration of all eligible inmates within 21 days from the 24th of June 2010 to enable those who wish to vote in a referendum to do so without hindrance.
These landmark orders were made after some 9 prisoners from Shimulateo Maximum Prison along Kenya's coast complained that their rights as Kenyan citizens will be violated should they not be given a chance to make a choice on the proposed new constitution of their country. The government wanted the case dismissed on the ground that the prisoners did not file the case personally and that it was a human rights lobby, Kituo cha Sheria, which did it on their behalf. Priscilla Nyokabi from Kituo cha Sheria is the one who represented the 9 prisoners.
It is a fantastic jurisprudence, and the progressive way in which the judges have been able to bring it out is something that is really, really welcome.
The court, however, clarified that prisoners in Kenya will only be allowed to take part in the August 4th referendum and not the general election. That is, in the election of president, member of parliament, or even local government leaders.
Odhiambo Joseph reporting from Nairobi. Listening to This Week in Africa on the BBC World Service with me, Akwesi Sapong. Still ahead, protests as some African artists fall foul of the UK's stringent new visa application processes.
The system is draconian, it's authoritarian. There are artists who are being refused visas because they don't have bank statements, because they can't prove that they have a certain amount of money in their bank accounts.
But first to Zimbabwe, where Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai reshuffled cabinet in a move which shocked his colleagues on the MDC side of the coalition government on Wednesday. It affected only members of his Movement for Democratic Change. Four ministers were sacked and eight others reassigned. While critics believe the move is partly to do with internal power struggles, the MDC leader says he wants to strengthen his party's role in government and bring efficiency. So, can the four new ministers succeed where their predecessors failed? It's the question Bilkisu Labaran put to John Makumbe, a professor of politics at the University of Zimbabwe in Harare.
They are expected to do better. They are at least going to benefit from the experience of the ones who are relieved of their duties. They may be able to see what mistakes they made and they try to improve on that.
Is this really about that, about their performance, the previous ministers in government, or is it about Mr. Tsvangirai shaking his MDC team up for results or just to show who really is the boss?
It is really about Mr. Tsvangirai shaking his team up for the referendum, which will be early next year, and the election later next year. It is really about ensuring that his team will actually give ZANU-PF a run for its money.
There are recent reports of divisions within the party.
Those are fiction, which is propagated by ZANU-PF and the Central Intelligence, as well as by the state media. They would like to give the impression that there is factionalism in the MDC.
And so what difference do you expect the fact of the four new ministers to make, especially in the energy sector now with a new minister? Will it stop the crippling power cuts in Zimbabwe?
I don't think so. There is very little that a new minister can do. There was sloppiness in the work of the outgoing minister in various ways. For example, the minister said there will be no power cut during the World Cup, but there are actually power cuts. As I talk to you, I don't have electricity at home. And so these things tend to follow a minister to the political dustbin, I'm afraid.
And how come all the four ministers that have been sacked are MDC members?
Tsvangirai only has power over MDC ministers. Robert Mugabe has powers over ZANU-PF ministers. But Robert Mugabe is not reshuffled because basically the whole team he leads, the ZANU-PF ministers, are all dead wood. If he reshuffles them, he might find he has no one to replace them with. He might even reshuffle himself out of cabinet.
Professor John Makumbe of the University of Zimbabwe. Now, could Tanzania be on its way to become the next African country with large, viable deposits of oil? The government certainly hopes so. It has just signed a deal with an Australian energy company to search for oil in the southern Lake Tanganyika. Beach Energy will invest $46 million in the project, which will be the first oil exploration in the area. Hopes of striking black gold are high. Further north in Lake Albert, the British company Tullow and the Canadian firm Heritage have found deposits of hundreds of millions of barrels of oil in Uganda over the past 7 years. Danny Burns is Beach Energy's International Managing Director.
Actually, East Africa is very attractive in terms of oil and gas, but it has so few wells drilled since the beginning of exploration, people don't really know what's going on. So it's very early days yet. It might seem there's a lot of activity, but it's still very early days.
Now, it is early days in East Africa, but you do say that more effort is being made to explore for oil in East Africa, in the region.
You have to remember, West Africa has something in the order of 25,000 wells drilled to date, whereas East Africa, the entire margin, including the interior, may be no more than about 450. It's like drilling a well in the North Sea and maybe not finding anything and saying there's nothing there.
Indeed. And from what you're saying, there seems to be a lot more exploration going on. Do you think there are going to be a lot of viable fines?
I think there will be a lot of fines because now a serious amount of investment is being made. And we've had a period of 5 or 6 years where companies have secured licenses, have negotiated with governments. I think Tanzania is a success story. They've pretty much licensed out all of their acreage. And now we're going to the next phase of looking at that data and then selecting areas where you might want to drill a well. And that is the final thing, the proof, really, is to drill that well. And there are many pitfalls on the way, and there are many distractions, and that's what needs to be done. And I think East Africa, in particular, is moving into that phase now.
Danny Burns of Beach Energy, which is exploring for oil in southern Tanzania. You're speaking to Bilkisu Labarang. Now, it's been nearly 5 years since one of the most ambitious aid packages for Africa was devised, but reviews are mixed on how successful the plans have been in reality. When developed nations under the G8 umbrella met at the Gleneagles Summit in 2005, they promised to double their aid to Africa by 2010, while Africa said it would end the coups and corruption that have blighted the lives of millions. Well, the world leaders are meeting this weekend in Canada at the latest G8 summit, but have they delivered on past promises of aid? Tom Cargill is the assistant head of the Africa program at the London-based think tank Chatham House. He came to our studio to speak to Paul Bachabinga.
Part of the promises have been delivered upon, but they were such ambitious pledges, and some of them were quite vague that it was always unlikely that all of them would be met. And this has been part of the problem with the G8 on Africa in recent years, that it's been making these bigger and bigger promises and fulfilling them less and less.
Why didn't they follow through? Is it because of the financial crisis, or is it lack of interest?
It's partly because of that, but the report that we've released argues that actually the reason is that it wasn't in the interests, or that G8 countries didn't realise it was in their interests to do these things. So it was just charity on their part. And what we argue is that they need to take much more of a strategic, trade-focused engagement with Africa that benefits their own people in Western countries, but also people in Africa as well.
You've mentioned trade. Has the financial crisis actually exposed the weakness of the Western capitalistic economic model?
Well, I think that's a good question. And many people around the world are looking east and looking at the emerging economies of the G20 as an alternative. I think this is an opportunity for Western countries to demonstrate, G8 countries to demonstrate that their belief in democracy, the free market, is still one that can succeed for people around the world by making sure that countries in Africa benefit from that as well and become wealthy and influential in their own right.
In your crystal ball, is there any hope that there will be a breakthrough in trade negotiations that could actually give Africa a fighting chance?
I think it's unlikely. I think history tells us that the countries that have the advantage in these things rarely give it up. It's African countries really need to play by their own rules rather than the rules of the West.
Tom Cargill, author of the report Africa's Role in the Post-G8 World, he was speaking to Paul Bachibinga. Now, it's a glorious summer here in Britain, a time when many international artists flock here to perform at various festivals. But African artists such as the Derange family from Senegal and the Amazons of Guinea are some acts that are falling foul of the country's stringent visa application processes. This is causing disruption to planned tours as well as a loss of money. The regulations have been in force since November 2008 and affect musicians, writers and academics. Now, there's an ongoing campaign to get them overturned that has gathered 10,000 signatures. Manik Govinda is a civil liberties activist with the Manifesto Club here in London. My colleague Paul Bachabinga asked him what they hoped to achieve.
We're calling for a review of the system. We think that the system is draconian, it's authoritarian, it's hugely overly bureaucratic. There are artists who are being refused visas because they don't have bank statements. There are artists who are being refused visas because they can't prove that they have a certain amount of money in their bank accounts. Now, 2-3 years ago, there was not this problem. All of these artists had no problem coming to the UK to perform. Now, why has it been over the last year and a half with the introduction of the points-based system that talented artists are now being reduced to being seen as so-called temporary workers or temporary migrants? That is not the case. These are talented individuals that should be welcome to our country.
Do you think that African artists are being disproportionately targeted?
I think it's African artists. I think it's artists from the Middle East. I think it's artists from what is perceived to be difficult countries.
But why should artists be exempt?
Artists are able to offer the gift of their creativity, of their talent, to a huge UK audience. So when you go to a concert to see very talented artists, Dara Djay family, for example, from Senegal, Les Frères Guiss from Senegal, or the Gunga Brass Band from Benin, all of these people are genuinely talented individuals being invited to festivals, being invited for concerts in the UK. Now, it's a huge letdown where we're hearing of fans, you know, that paid for tickets to go and see these groups having to be disappointed.
But the fact is that some groups, you know, like if they're huge ensembles, when they come into the country, some people disappear into the system.
No.
Which creates a problem.
I disagree. There is no evidence of this. I think that when the various festivals and the various concert halls invite these artists and invite these writers, there is a contract and a trust. There is no need for a government to lay on numerous layers of bureaucracy for people to jump through.
Mani Govinda is a civil liberties activist with the Manifesto Club here in London. And there we end our look at events this week in Africa. You can catch the very latest from the continent later today in Focus on Africa at 1900 GMT. Until then, thanks for listening and bye for now.